Hello, Zero Books viewers and readers. It's Pop the Left, I should say, with Derek Barn. I'm Douglas Lane. In this episode of the live stream and podcast, we'll be talking about Trump. We try not to talk about Trump most of the time, although we often end up talking about him. This is going to be a two-parter. We'll do our Parrot Room or our private pop conversation for Patreon supporters after we record this one. So you should support us in the Parrot Room or Patreon room if you like what we do. I'm just going to say that right at the top. The other thing that's going to happen in this live stream is I will solve the Rubik's Cube. Now, it may look like I've got it set so that it's very easy to solve, but I do. But I set it that way myself, all right? So it's not cheating. But yeah, so
I can vouch for this. He was doing the algorithm before we began.
Yes. So Derek, do you think that we're going to have an actual election in November? Are we looking at a coup from Trump? We both read this piece in the Atlantic about the likelihood of there being a constitutional crisis. How serious do you think this is?
I'm of two minds about it. When I read it, that article, and we'll go through it, it's kind of a mess. Mm-hmm. There are some serious legal challenges that the Trump administration can put out. There's also a counter narrative I've actually seen some Democratic operatives say that even the coup leaks and stuff were actually part of Trump's PR to appeal strong to unify his base. There's a lot of calls and in the fringes of his base for exactly that. I mean, it's very strange, but like Alex Jones has been talking about the necessity of military coups and stuff recently. But, you know, for Trump. At the same time, a lot of the string of the worst case scenario presented in that Atlantic article is dependent on some things involving state legislatures and judicial appointments that is a vast overclaim. I can't see certain Republican states just caving to the federal government or the executive like that. So in that sense, you know, I think, no, we're not going to have a coup, but I think it will be a mess. And I think it's designed to be a mess. If anything, from what I saw on the debate the other day, Trump's two real strategies seem to be merely appeal and strengthen the base and cause chaos so that his opponents can't make like clear appeals. That's pretty much all I'm seeing as a strategy. Now, as far as like how that matters for us, it essentially doesn't. I mean, like, one of the things that might come up for this, you know, as we talk about this with Trump, is I think we're out of the game. I think the left has nothing to say now. I don't think we're gonna. I think once Bernie caved to Biden, there really isn't anything left for the left to really do. We're not the demographic that they care about. And frankly, even if we were to peel off in large numbers, unless we did it in very specific states, which we're not generally in, it doesn't matter.
So just to be clear, the idea is that because of mail-in voting, the election won't be determined quickly, which would give Trump the opportunity to have another Brooks Brothers riot and try to slow down the counting, not the recount as it was in 2000, but just the counting in various states. Mm-hmm. And then as that happens, if he can slow that down enough, it will be unclear as to who. I mean, there's more steps. I'm skipping over steps from the Atlantic article, but it will be unclear when the electors are selected, who should be selected. And in Republican states, Trump might be able to get his slate of electors to be sent to Washington alongside of Biden's or instead of Biden's. And that will produce a constitutional crisis where all sorts of things happen in the courts and then also in the Congress, so that we could be looking at a moment where Biden, Trump, and Nancy Pelosi all have some sort of claim on the presidency.
Right. Although assuming Nancy Pelosi like keeps her seat and her role as House Speaker. But yeah, I mean, there would be a possible triple claim. However, I want to caveat this, though, on the other side of all this, you know, when I talk about how we don't have much to do about this, is I remember similar claims being made at the end of the Bush administration.
Not by the Atlantic, though. I mean,
it is different, but is it different? What's different, though? Like, I really want you to think about what is different. Greg Palast was talking about this stuff from 2004 to 2008 in The Guardian. So it wasn't a U.S. press. Naomi Wolf wrote a whole book about it, which did go out to progressive like book clubs and all that in the late aughts, because I got it from it, unfortunately. Yeah. So while it was a marginal view, you didn't have it in like the journals of high opinion. The journals of high opinion have changed profoundly.
That's true. That's true. But it's also brought up in the debate. And it was never brought up in any of the debates with George Bush.
No, it was not.
This has become a mainstream, as much as there is a mainstream, and there may not be, but as much as there is a mainstream, you know, venue left, as much as there's a mainstream opinion or topics for mainstream discussion, this has become a mainstream talking point where it was not in 2008.
But we have to ask ourselves, not if Trump can tie it up in the courts. I think pretty clearly he has a team of lawyers that could slow things down. Why would this be an effective Democratic talking point? And why would this be an effective Republican talking point? Because frankly, we have to assume lizard brain logic and not just paranoia is propelling this, which means like, even if the Democrats were afraid of it, if they didn't think they could gain something by stoking this fear, why would they do it? If it was a possibility.
Yeah. I mean, I went through this and had some questions about it. One thing that, if I'm going to put on like my bipartisan hat or try to pretend like I'm not aligned with any side of this, less and less aligned with either side, one thing that they might be trying to do is downplay their own shenanigans in the upcoming election and prime people to their own base to ignore certain kinds of improprieties and write them off. So the one question I had is it true that all of Trump's claims about vote fraud and ballot stuffing and ballot harvesting is really baseless? And it was very difficult to find that out. I mean, obviously it's not outside the realm of the possible, because in 1960, it was precisely that kind of thing that was at issue in the Kennedy-Nixon election. And there was some evidence, although an investigation determined that the vote fraud that existed wasn't determinative, but there was at least some evidence of vote fraud in that election that made the national news. You know, it was consequential in the way it was perceived, if not in the outcome.
Well, so there's two ways to look at this. One, the reality of voter suppression would help the Republicans. Two, the perception of possible voting suppression helps motivate a Democratic base. It is actually one of those like devil's bargains where both sides in a way can benefit and try to motivate their base by attempting this stuff. I mean, when you look at it from a standpoint of not like what the left should do, but just in the assuming this is being treated as a highly cynical game, and I think at some level you do have to assume that. what does it mean that Trump can tie it up in the courts, and why, what benefit, even if he was going to win legitimately, would he have to push that? How does voter suppression help him? I mean, it's clear that he has no real road to run the popular vote, but that's not the important vote.
Right. The,
it also is clear that his support amongst older boomers in the Rust Belt is declining.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly his base is like a very embittered, sorry, Doug, Gen X.
How dare you speak the truth about my generation?
Hyper conservative, but it's not all your generation. But I mean, like it's a rump part of it, and some very deracinated petite bourgeois, you know, people. I mean, Trump benefits also from the idea that he's leading a working class adjacent campaign, not because he's going to get working class votes or even wants to, but so that they will sit on their hands during the election. I mean, like, that's really, and you know, that strategy worked for him. One of the things that I noticed, you know, there's not much to glean from the debates, particularly in light of this article, but there are some things to think about. There are ways in which Trump's appeals have changed. Even fairly asinine blowhard that the NYT pointed out, that like Trump has stopped making appeals to the working class, disaffected Bernie bro base, which he actively did in the debates with Hillary Clinton,
yeah,
and also in some of his early policy proposals, which he dropped. Instead, now those same people are painted as people who are going to team up with BLM and a bunch of Antifa street gangs, probably funded by China, according to him, and like burn down all the cities, which means that he no longer sees the need or the ability to expand his voter base. Anyone who went into the election, there are some, I did find some.
Can I jump in and intervene and say, look, I'm not sure that that is entirely reflects his assessment of his voter base and exactly, but maybe it reflects a change in how generally the left and those kinds of, and Bernie Sanders is perceived, that in this moment where the streets are filled or have been filled with riotous protests for so long, and those protesters are associated with the left of the Democratic Party, it no longer makes sense for him to have those kinds of appeals in his own rhetoric, because the working class people that would have supported him before no longer find those kinds of appeals attractive.
Well, okay, but let's flip this, because this is where I'm going to call you out for living in Portland. Okay. The expansion of the BLM protest in the way that they have played out as kind of riot porn,
mm-hmm,
that's unique to the Pacific Northwest. It has happened a little bit in the Midwest around Kenosha, but like we saw that up until maybe August here in Salt Lake, but that's not even though there's still plenty of protesting, that's not happening anymore.
Sure, but everyone's inside, everyone's sharing the kind of collective hallucination, and Portland gets into the news feeds. I mean, I'm not saying that it's happening in every city, but also the original riots that started in late May and swept through the country in the early June, they hit a lot of places, and the impact on working class people was not good for the most part.
It also wasn't, I mean,
it wasn't, it certainly at that point, there was not a feeling that the left was a villain.
No,
it's happening. But then you wait 3 months and you have white kids in Portland take the mantle of the riotous protest. That kind of recasts the whole moment. But Black Lives Matter is pushed to the back.
Doug, you're very online. Like,
extremely online.
And I sometimes think one of the reasons why the left has been blindsided by the popular mood over and over again is it's very online.
Yeah.
Like, I actually don't, like, I hear these things, I listen to, like, Robert Evans and all those people, you know, out of Portland, and, you know, even our mutual friend Jeremy Salmon telling me these things, And I go and talk to regular people here in SLC in June, it was a point of paranoia where, and also people didn't know who they really sided with. Now people just kind of think it's a bunch of crazy people on the West Coast fighting with sticks again. Like that, like to some people, it's just like, you live in Little Beirut. Someone needs to take you, you know, someone needs to take all you weird ass Idaho, like lumping petite weirdos starting checkpoints and all the Antifa. I mean, the sentiment here is basically, we'd be fine if we locked you guys down and fought, and you were just allowed to fight your death forever. Like, we don't care.
So how is what you're saying counter to what I'm saying?
It's not, except that it's not, it wouldn't affect anyone either way. They don't really see it. Like, here, let me talk to you about, like, Trump's, like, let's look at, like, how
so Trump... They don't associate that with Bernie Sanders or...
No, I don't think so.
Democratic. Okay, that was my... claim.
They might in New York, and see, this is where it's a little bit complicated. In places where the DSA was like actually substantively strong, there might be more association with this. But in the vast majority of the country, I suspect it's seen as a regional problem with a bunch of weirdos. Like,
well, that's like probably not inaccurate.
I mean, that's what I get from talking to people around here. I mean, people, yes, they have vague allegiances to Antifa. Or they have vague allegiances to the weirdo militias, but they're all seen as like a little bit odd. There was an attempt around August for that kind of stuff to bleed into here with like Utah Alarm. And then we had, like, in the last week, we've had weird stuff like Black Lives Matter doing joint in Northern Utah doing joint events with the Proud Boys to like settle stuff down. Like, as weird as that sounds. Mm. So, like, I don't think that's going to have a lot of purchase in a lot of the country. And the thing I think is telling about the left response, and, like, we can get back to the Trump, like, the Trump theories on how we can jam this up. But Trump's attempt to use the DHS to pour fire on the situation was also attempted to be spread out to actual Black communities in Chicago, and it didn't work. It had no effect. Like, well, no one took the bait.
I don't even understand what that would have looked like. He was saying that he was going to send federal troops to fight regular everyday crime in Chicago.
Right.
The amount of force you'd have to put on the ground to try to do that would have been so immense. I mean, it's not like there would be a little pocket of rioters that you could go and confront. Right. You would have to spread yourself throughout the city. And
Border Patrol is not actually trained to do that.
And, like, and as soon as you tried to do that on the scale that was necessary, you know, you would, I think the level of outrage from everyday people would be off the charts. I'm not sure we could really do that at all, ultimately, but without bringing the actual military.
But the actual military won't. One of the things that is also heartening, but also something we could consider, the military probably doesn't want Biden to win or Trump to win. The military wants to appear as neutral as possible for two reasons. One, if the military extends its power out in a way that is obvious, it actually hurts its power base and destabilizes its main source of power, which is the U.S. dollar. If it does that, it's got to be really pushed against the wall. I mean, the top brass knows that. Whatever, you know, like average military people feel, which from polls ranges all over the place.
Yeah.
But the top brass has been pretty clear. They don't really like Trump. You've had several former defense, you know, we have Mateus to other people just saying they don't think he's even that fit. They don't see him as competent. They've not said anything about Biden, and they've said explicitly they will be neutral in this and just enforce the Constitution.
Yeah.
And the reason
I think if Trump had to rely on the military to support some kind of coup, he would be SOL. I mean, right. I don't think that would happen. And I'll just confirm what you're saying also, that like my wife, who works at the VA hospital, kind of reports into me, not like she does surveys, but she tells me about her patients who hate Trump just about as often as she tells me about her patients who love Trump. I wouldn't say that there was a particular bias. I mean, maybe the ones who love Trump are less likely to tell her, but she's not asking either, right? And so So this is anyway. So I think that the vets overall are not particularly in love with Trump.
At this point. I mean,
at least not in Oregon at the VA hospital.
So one of the things that's coming up, I'm seeing in the live stream that I am going to address is what do you mean that U.S. military's power is in the dollar? The exchange rate, the power of the dollar is its ability to buy like physical commodities, and in this case, weapons. And the stability of the dollar is a lot of the reason why there is an imperial military project. That's what a lot of the goal is. It was like, for example, if you really study what went on in Iraq, you weren't fighting over oil. You were fighting over oil futures. You know, no one was going to go in and suck up all the Iraqi oil. What they wanted was an increase in oil futures. And I'm sure they wanted other things. I actually don't have a unicausal theory of why the Iraq war happened, why the Middle Eastern expansion happened. I think most of those are vulgar, populist, and dumb. But there is an element to the fact that there's an like the military's mission is partially economic. And that's also why it's given a kind of like economic Keynesian project that's still allowed to exist. It also, frankly, keeps a lot of the red states from completely collapsing from their own, you know, unproductivity. Like, you know, where I'm at in Georgia, as that military largesse has died off, the region where I'm from has just died. And so that's because it was sustained by military Keynesianism. Those projects are very much tied together. Like when I've been thinking more and more about this, you know, in a highfalutin way, I've been thinking about how politics may be really subsumed to capital in a way that makes utilizing an executive figure very, very hard for the left to do. And I have kind of been trying to articulate that to people for about 6 years about like my skepticism about Bernie Sanders. Not that we shouldn't support him, but we should be both that the MMT projects would probably not be as stable as they think. But even beyond that, even if it kind of was for a brief period of time, there are ways in my head where I could play out. It could be helpful for 10, 15 years, you know, half of a long business cycle, right? To one whole regular one.
Well, not in the context of the pandemic.
No, it won't work now. This is before you have an external shock.
Right.
But one of the things, and if people don't believe me on that, look at China, because that's what the MMTers always go to as their counterexample for how this could work, and it's not working there. So my thing about the military is this instability is not good for it. What the question I have is not, could Trump wreak havoc? It's, why would anyone let him? Because let's face it, Trump is a vulgar, like, pitch man. He's not even a particularly good businessman, as the controversy about his taxes recently has indicated. But he's very good at playing a game and making people believe he is good as a businessman. Why would the real sources of power in the United States tolerate that? Why would the elite bourgeoisie? Why would...
Here's what I would say, reading that Atlantic piece, is that one of the real sources of power in the United States is our formal constitutional structure, and so he has an opportunity by law. He has opportunities which he doesn't need anyone's permission to take. So the real power of the constitutional protections is sort of half broken, which would allow him as president to go down this path. There was no legitimate force that could stop him, unless you're talking about something outside of the formal system of power, like his own family or advisors, or you know, something that would say, look, you go down this path and we're going to crush you in this way or that way. But it would have to come from within his own base, within his own side of the equation, like if people who maybe were going to cut a media deal with him or that kind of thing, rather than, you know, the actual opposition, like wouldn't it be the Democrats or any arms of the state that would be able to stop him.
Right. It's interesting that it's interesting to think about this. So in terms of like the way commodities work. And again, I'm actually looking at some of the comments here, because for once they're relevant. Somebody is saying that stability doesn't equal strong currency, and many militaries don't need a strong currency. You're right, but those militaries are not in the head of an empire. You need to go study Britain. And imperial militaries versus rump militaries and militaries in the periphery. You can't make a one-to-one comparison to the way a military works and in a peripheral nation to the way the military works in the core of Capital Two.
Is that because strong militaries within a nation are relying on their own production more?
Well, that's part of it. There's also like the fact that if things start really degenerating in a periphery, you can basically go to extractive modes of production. Like, you know what Ben Burgess would call pre-capitalist modes, or you can go into straight up domination, in which case a strong military is also useful, and a military could handle that, but not in the core of the economy.
No, but we're talking about the strong currency, not the strong military. I mean, I can see why you would need a strong military for imperial primitive extraction, but you need a strong currency is because you need to be able to dominate markets.
Well, no, you need a currency. You actually, again, strong here may be misleading, because again, both you and a commenter are bringing this up, and I want to like clarify this because I know what they're bringing up. If our currency was too strong, would actually like too strong against other foreign currencies, actually be a problem. It would limit a whole lot of the international exchange. There's actually kind of a Goldilocks standard that we've been active, like we don't actively peg our currency in a lot of ways, but we kind of do. And
we manipulate our currency to the best of our ability.
Yeah, I mean, like monetarism is about keeping the inflation rate at about 3% so that we can be in the kind of Goldilocks zone for internal, because you want it to be able to, like, our part of what we do in the function of the circuit of world capital, right, is eat up a lot of other countries overproduction. Like, that's why China and the U.S. have this weird, like, tense, we need to hate each other in some ways, but if, like, we actually go full bore against each other, it's a disaster for both parties. China has to deal with its overproduction problem, its attempt to kind of manage its capital development in a way that can continually create a middle class and end a lot of its still pretty significant rural poverty, which it's done successfully now for 2.5 decades. Would end. And one of the things that they're dealing with right now, and it's actually coming out not so much intentions with us, but intentions with India, is the fact that the business cycle is really affecting their ability to do that. They're now dealing with a real business cycle because survey says they're a capitalist economy. Or at least they're so, even if you don't think they are, they're so keyed into the international capitalist production chain that they cannot get themselves out of it. Mm-hmm. So that's one problem. Second problem that we have in regards to Trump and the courts, if Trump did this in the courts, let's say, like, do we think it would mess with the viability of U.S. financial institutions? Because that's, you know, if you look at where U.S. power really is, it's in the military, and it's not in direct military force, actually. Like, that's another thing. Like I think one of the things people have missed is how much those adventures in the Middle East hurt our hard military force. But there's other things that we're doing.
We're also the world's second largest productive economy.
Right.
That's not small potatoes either. I mean.
Right.
We provide a lot of stuff for the world still. I'm not saying that it's, you know, our primary mode of domination, but without it, we wouldn't be here.
Well, I mean, that's my main argument against MMT. Why can't anyone who doesn't have a highly productive commodity economy just do it? Why do they all end up pegging their currency to either the yuan or the dollar, no matter what?
But I think we should do a whole episode on monetary theory and do it rigorously and come back to Trump now, because
we're getting into the weeds, but I don't think you can cut out like why certain factions of the government, which, you know, conservatives will call the deep state, which they give like almost superhuman powers that there's no way our governmental apparatus is that competent. Like, even in a good,
they can read your mind, man. What are you talking about?
The right.
Deep states. I saw men who stare at goats. They can do all sorts of stuff.
One of the things I think about right now that I think COVID has only exacerbated, but we've been heading this way for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to start seeing it in the left now that the Bernie movement's over, is we are in a very, even for America, a very paranoid moment. We were in a paranoid moment going into the end of the last financial crisis. And it was kind of suppressed for it seems like by a bunch of different moods. There was more social optimism amongst younger people for the Obama years. A lot of the left conspiracy people, just as they got older, soured into just being right wing conspiracy people.
That happens a lot.
Right. I mean, but one of the things you and I have talked about privately that I think this gets into is liberals have been flirting with this conspiracy culture in a way that you hadn't really seen them do very often until the end of the Bush administration. You saw a little bit at the end. They've been doing that since 2016.
Yeah, well, Russiagate is the prime example.
Right. I mean, and there's a kind of simpleton's notion of a simpleton and populist. And when I say populist here, I know there's a lot of defenders of like Tom Frank. The reason why I use it as an insult is populist understanding of class interest is immediate. Thomas Lash talks about this. This usually
Christopher Lash.
I mean, yeah, Christopher Lash, not Thomas Lash.
Thomas
Frank is defending it right now, and his arguments against anti-populism are actually really good, but his arguments for populism are not. And I know that's a strange thing to say, but like he's right about the anti-populist like sentiment and what they're doing right now. What he is not looking at, and what Lash pointed out and what that happened in the 1890s to the 1930s, is as if you don't have a sufficiently complex notion of class interest and you have immediate actor interest, you are going to be given to massive conspiracy theories over time. And the other thing is, like, since the 70s, we know that some of those conspiracies, you know, are true. Like, if you talk to either one of us, and you and I used to be on opposite sides of this question, Doug, but there were times when, trooferism, 9/11 trooferism, we're not going to rehash this, but you and I, yay!
I just did that off camera. So.
9/11 trooferism was something that, you know, you were tangentially involved from the left. I was tangentially opposing from the left. Mm-hmm. And I, over time, came to a position that, of course, it was really the terrorists who blew up the buildings, but the government knew more than the 9/11 report said. And you also came to the same conclusion.
Yeah.
I think that has turned back on its head. I mean, I'm not going to call out any specific podcast or anything like that, although there's a lot of very
TruAnon.
Right. What, I mean, TruAnon started off as like tracing and debunking these conspiracy theories, and then started going into the actual conspiracies that the government has had to mess with the left, which, you know, I remember talking to you about this in early Pop the Left Round 1 days, when I said, of course they're doing that. That's a baseline assumption. You should assume the powers that be do not want a revolutionary force to emerge. Like, duh. But on another level, like, this tends, over-focusing on the conspiracy nature of it tends to lead to a kind of counter-conspiracy narrative. I foresee what we're in right now is that paranoia because of COVID, because of lockdown, because of the social distrust, because of the way that our empire does look to be kind of highly unstable right now. The Middle East seems to have been our Trajan's Wall moment. Like, you're not going any further. However, so
did we even want to? Was there?
I don't know. Like, I don't think we really did, but it's hard. It is hard to, I think we would have liked a lot more proxies. The thing is, we have a lot of proxies in that area now. Like,
I think that our foreign policy is just like everything else, just a matter of crisis management and without a real long-term strategy. I don't think that we...
I think there was an attempt at a long-term strategy in the new American century, and that went up in flames by 2007.
Yeah.
And we've just been coasting. And you're right. But one of the interesting things about both Obama and Trump, one of the ways that they're alike that I don't see pointed out a lot of the time, mm-hmm. is that Obama was also in this mitigation crisis management mode the entire time. And he made a lot of enemies, particularly in the Middle East, by not picking sides and being in that mode. Like, he was hated when I was living in Egypt because, not because he sided with, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood or he sided with Sisi. It's because he sided with both and neither. And for a little while, there is this class divide where the very well-educated Egyptians were against Trump, but the mass of people in Egypt were actually kind of for him, which, you know, I remember telling people and they'd be shocked, but that all ended as soon as Trump pulled up the stuff with Israel and that, you know, of course, ended that. So I just bring all this up to bring up the fact that, like, we're in a very, very paranoid moment. The other thing that I want to point out...
I just have to ask, do you think that there's a possibility that this paranoia has some basis in kind of like his maybe half-remembered, like a half-memory of 2000, say? Because if you read the Atlantic piece and you think about it as telling the story of what would have happened in 2000 if it had been Trump in Al Gore's shoes rather than Al Gore, you know, it starts to cohere a little bit more as a story, because if Al Gore had wanted to, there were still options open to him after the Supreme Court decisions, but they may have caused a constitutional crisis. So, but people on the left, even like Jimmy Carter, apparently thought he should have gone further.
Right.
Of course, at least run again, but he thought he should have gone further then as well.
So one of the things I'll say about the United States politics that we haven't talked enough about, and maybe we should talk a little bit more about it now, is a lot of the bullshit that we're seeing is stuff that, you know, we participated in other countries for a long time and it's come home. And so there is a real sense where there is a danger of, like with Russiagate, there are, like, I reject the overall Russiagate narrative, but there are specific elements of Russiagate that are probably true. I don't think they changed the election results at all.
Yeah.
But this dependence on these plausible things is shot throughout the system. And, you know, the paranoia, though, like, for example, someone like Newt Gingrich, who, you know, since I'm from Georgia, I've known about him forever. I would have never assumed to be someone who would have been censored on Fox News for bringing up Soros conspiracies.
Mm.
All right. For whatever he was, he was not that operatively. So there's a sense in which both sides know the paranoia benefits them. And in that sense, there is a possibility that what the Atlantic sees is a real possibility, because if you play with paranoia for long enough, it may actually be viable for someone to try to pull a stunt off. And we know that voter suppression is a real thing. I also think there is a chance that the mail-in ballots are going to get wonky. But I live in a state, like, I live in Utah. Utah is a conservative state that has had mail-in ballots for like 20 years, and it's been fine. Like,
But that's an entirely different scenario than New York, which has had the level of mail-in ballots as has now for what, 8 months?
Right. I mean,
20 years and all at once.
I mean, in this sense, like, I think I don't even foresee malfeasance being an issue. I see basic incompetence being
rampant. Well, look, it's a common, that's the thing. Like, we're looking at a situation where the system is not able to adequately in a timely manner count the vote. And it will likely be very close. And we have a motivated politician and probably two politicians who are motivated to go all the way to the mat.
Mm-hmm.
And not to bow out for the sake of constitutional
So then stability. The fate of the country rests on John Roberts not wanting a future Democratic administration to pack the court.
Yeah. But I don't think the Democrats are likely to, if Biden wins, I don't think he's likely to pack the
court. No, I don't think that either. That's actually what I'm saying. But if they lost off of a Supreme Court nomination, I think they would pack the court next round. The other thing that I think we need to look at is how likely a lot of these conditions are going to be reversed fast enough for whoever wins the next election to have their party continue their lead. And if I almost feel like if we get Biden, it is likely to be a one-term deal. I'm not saying for sure he's going to step out, but he is
old. Well, he said he won't run a second term himself.
He has.
I think he's already committed to that. Yeah.
You see, I've heard that said, but I've actually not found where it was said.
No, I feel like that was something I heard on Rising.
Mm-hmm.
It said, and that it was reported as something he had said, and so.
Right, I've seen it said about him, but I actually can't find where it would have been originally said. But let's just assume that's the case. We're back in this scenario in 4 years with two new candidates, and
one of them is Kamala Harris.
And one of them is Kamala Harris. And again, the hope that the Democrats are going to have they have to win the Senate to have enough power to do anything of any significance, particularly with the courts being as. Frankly, that's the one thing Trump was able to really do was stack courts as part of his kind of grand bargain with the evangelicals was stacking courts in their favor, even if that meant put a bunch of Catholics in. The other thing that I think is interesting about this is a lot of the far-right weirdos are going to get weirder. One of the things that I've, you know, unfortunately, I expose myself to that world every now and then, so I know what I'm talking about. And I was surprised to hear that there's a lot of anti-Amy Coney Barrett on sentiment over there because they think there's too many Catholics on the court. And they also, she is not anti-vax and anti-lockdown, you know. And so that actually upsets part of the Yahoo base. But I don't think enough that they break with Trump, but I literally heard them like making arguments that we need to keep fighting for Trump so Trump can stand against people like Amy Coney Barrett, who Trump is nominating to the Supreme Court. Like that world is going bonkers. And a lot of that world, a lot of the racialist element of that world, I think they're abandoning Trump because he has not been the God Emperor they hope for, and they also kind of want stability even more than they want, you know.
Spencer said he was going to vote Biden because of COVID, and he would like a competent leader, please.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I mean, like,
you how dedicated he is to overturning the multicultural, Jewish-run United States of America.
Well, one of the things I like to like think about in this is a lot of these we on the margins like to like follow our bizarro world enemies on the other margins,
mm-hmm.
But I do think we kind of miss that the Bannon wing was never significant, and that's weird deal, like other than Steve Saylor, Steve Miller, which is the one closest to an outright white supremacist, even though he's Jewish in the administration, Steve Miller?
Yeah, I guess. I can't remember. I can't keep them all
straight. Yeah. But,
yeah, well, we emphasized the most reactionary aspects of the Trump administration. In this moment, we're being told by not just the left. In fact, the left is, kind of, as you said, irrelevant. Like, the left doesn't quite know how to respond to this moment. You're not hearing even that strong a call to just hold your nose and vote for Biden is sort of being said quietly, I think, more quietly than... Are you hearing it a lot, to hold your nose and vote for Biden?
Here's the thing. I'm not hearing it because it doesn't really need to be said. Howie Hawkins is not... Like, even though there's been a disproportionate increase in Howie Hawkins and Joe Jorgensen support... We've seen these third party increases in the last two rounds. The weird thing about the Hawkins and Jorgensen is they actually balance each other out. Like, so
people could just decide not to vote,
right? Yeah. Which is also likely. I mean, that's which makes the third party spoiler argument, except in the cases of someone like Ross Perot, where there was such a large percentage,
yeah,
kind of a hard argument.
But my point is that that people aren't that the left isn't really, you know, I don't think it's well if what Biden did at the debate last night, like I'm just confirming what you said. What Biden did at the debate the other night is indicative of something. It's indicative of the fact that Biden doesn't think that the Green New Deal wing of the Democratic Party is going to be decisive in this election. And I tend to agree with him. And I'm not sure if that's because it doesn't need to be said to vote for Biden, or it's because the Democratic Party has gotten a new path for itself with a new voting base.
Probably a little bit of both. I think there's this, like the Lincoln Project stuff is where they're going to appeal. There's also the fact that the left did not actually use its ability, its boost a year ago to pull into areas that were not traditionally Democratic. It just didn't. It didn't make appeals to non-Democratic constituencies in large numbers. If you look at where the DSA had success, that it was electoral. It's in places where you'd expect progressive Democrats would also gather a seat if there was any chance for them to do so.
Yeah, but going back to the Trump coup, the point is, if it's the case that the left doesn't matter here, then we can't really chalk up the paranoia from the Atlantic to the usual left dynamic that we've seen before. No. And which means I do wonder if the combination of the pandemic and kind of disreputable presidential candidate may actually represent a constitutional crisis on the scale of 2000, only without Al Gore to put a lid on it at the right moment.
Look, I'm going to be honest with you, Doug. The Constitution is falling apart and has been for about 50 years. This is one thing that I've tracked in my entire political life, even when I was not a left winger. The Constitution is Swiss cheese at this point. The only thing that holds it up are norms largely established just as informal norms since Watergate. That is why these holes have not, we haven't fallen into them before. We kind of did in 2000, but even then there was enough respect for formal decorum that you didn't really want to tear the whole thing down by pointing out that the Constitution was Swiss cheese at this point from a mixture of ad hoc Supreme Court rulings in both right and left directions to the way that the legislative had given up powers that I'm not even sure it had the ability to give up.
I'm aware of how the constitutional protections that citizens used to expect has been undermined since at least 2000, since in the Bush years particularly, but even in Clinton's time before that. But I'm not as aware of the way the constitutional rules around, say, elections has been beaten up over the last... Since Watergate.
The constitutional rules around election assumed a fairly equal spread amongst the states so that there would be no incentive for a state to pull a stunt. Because frankly, if you read the Constitution, all voting rights, including for federal elections, are state matters. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that has not been a problem before is basically informal norms and agreements between the parties.
For the last 200 years or more, because it's not 1976 anymore, the country has had constitutional problems. It's been a jerry-rigged system from the beginning. It's had these holes from the start.
And if it wasn't, we wouldn't have the Civil War, Doug. But like even beyond that, it's been a matter of the federal government patching holes and often those holes being put back in by the Supreme Court. For example, the Slaughterhouse Acts, which, you know, undo large parts of the 13th Amendment. These are things that have been happening for a long time and they have not been a problem because of informal norms. The amount of things, and it has broken down a few times. It broke down during FDR, which is when they started imposing, like they started having constitutional amendments to impose norms that were priorly just normative. Like you only ran twice, So now we're going to make you only run twice because we don't want a president for life. And you also had the attempt to stack the courts, which was not actually that wasn't undone by constitutional fiat. But they were afraid that if they did allow FDR to do it, that they would have to do that. And then it would become a partisan issue. The willingness to avoid those cliffs, and I'm not, you know, not just in the sense of rights, but also look at the way we've been dealing with federal funding for the past almost two decades, where like you have brinkmanship over budget limits and all that because of a collapse in basic governmental functioning that has only been patched by the norm that you don't do it. Like, or the fact that if you really do it, you're going to collapse the dollar, you know, or whatever. Like, so this is where things are really breaking down because those norms don't hold anymore. So yes, we're going to have, like, I think inevitably, if you want the constitutional crisis element of this, not the coup part, but the constitutional crisis element of this, we are there. We have been there for a while. It is undeniable now.
Well, So that's the thing about this Atlantic piece is that it isn't the story of a military coup or a dictator taking power. That isn't the story they're spinning.
No,
the story they're spinning in the Atlantic piece is the story of a constitutional crisis wherein Trump maintains his power through the kinds of shenanigans that we saw in 2000 only. It has a more deleterious effect on the Republic because it's seen it's more naked and more partisan. Because he's really setting up in advance the idea that the that his base will see any attempt by the Democrats to get their votes counted as an attempted voter fraud. And of course the Democrats will see everything he does as basically a Mussolini style coup.
Right. I mean, the other thing that we have to put into this is there's some other elements of Trump, you know, in his bad bourgeoisness that we have to like look at. People are always like, he's going to go to prison. Well, no, he's not going to go to prison. But you know what is going to happen in a year?
What?
He's on the line for some debts he personally secured that he cannot pay. Now, that's not going to go away as he's president. I don't think there's no legal means to do that. So one of the things that I have seen floated around is that this idea of him as the government in exile would be financially good for him with things like the OWN network. I think it's OWN, whatever the extreme conservative network.
Have more of ability to make money if he's no longer president.
Yeah. I've seen people posit that. I don't know that that's actually what's going on, but I mean, that's a viable explanation.
Billions of dollars worth of debt. Is that something that came out in his tax returns recently?
Yeah.
I know that he was in a lot of debt, but I wasn't sure how he could claim to be. I mean, I wasn't sure how they could say he had a net worth of X amount, you know, millions and millions and not billions, and also claim that he was billions in the hole.
Because he still has all the hard assets, but the hard assets he's had to refinance several times to keep him running. And now in the last round, he refinanced off of personal collateral, meaning if he can't pay as this loan ends, he's on the hook for it, not his business, which is weird. Like it's not a normal business structure thing. So,
yeah, that is that. I mean, if he did that, that would really be unusual. And it might, if things went badly, it might actually give everyone their moment of what is the word I'm looking? Schadenfreude or whatever.
Yeah, Schadenfreude. Yeah.
Schadenfreude.
But, you know, but I also like you could see Trump benefiting from spinning this that he's a legitimate president without him sitting just as easily as him sitting. That's the thing. The government of exile with a bunch of like 30% of the population like entertaining and maybe 25% hard believing and super loyal to you, that's a great business model, if nothing else. Like there's all kinds of other reasons to do this. And let's look this on its head. Let's say that Trump does still leave at the end of this. We still don't have a legitimate clearly legitimate president from the eyes of like at least 35% of the public.
Yeah, 30 to 40%. Yeah, that's the thing. The outcome at the end, whether Trump remains in power or not, is not the most significant part of the Atlantic story.
It's a constitutional crisis.
Yeah, the most significant part of the Atlantic story is how ill-prepared, how this country can't apparently pull off the most basic thing a democratic republic is supposed to be able to pull off, which is a fucking election where you have the vote and count the votes. That's going to be difficult. That to me, if you really stop and think about that for a moment, it's a fucking shame.
But you have to remember why this wasn't a problem in the pre-20th century republic. The federal government was not designed to be this democratic. And as it was reformed into it, those reforms weren't completed until the 1970s, including more and more people into the primary process, making that part of a popular vote within states, or, having some sort of state system that tying those electors to popular votes in many states. All these reforms are on a system that was not built for it. All right. The way the governments were originally supposed to work was the lower you got down, the more democratic it was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true. That's actually not true in either direction anymore. You will also notice that because of gerrymandering, power blocks, the fact that everyone's focused on national issues, not local ones, this to me, COVID has also exposed how much these local issues really mattered and how we have just let all that get gutted. Not just in the area of elections, but also just basic health functions, school boards, and governments answering to other parts of state governments. That's been handled by inertia and norms in most states for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as if empire has made us unaware of how lazy we were. But it's built on a system that we clued together. It's been clued by legislation. It's been clued by state level reforms. It's been clued by it's been patched up by giving the Supreme Court too much power, frankly, to patch it up because it had holes in it. We're the oldest. I mean, yes, we're a young nation. I always hear that shit from liberals all the time. But we're the oldest constitutional republic on the planet. No one else's constitution has been allowed to exist this long. I mean, France is on what? It's six. I mean, this is fifth republic, but there's also been constitutional empires and stuff. So we shouldn't be surprised that we are heading into major constitutional crisis territory. And also the other thing that we talked about, us as the second most productive nation, and we have a lot more purchasing power and a lot more wealth than the first most productive nation. But you know the last time that was a thing in world history?
No.
1910. The United States was outproducing Britain, and Britain was still the imperial head. We were at the point China is to us. Now, I actually don't see the analogy as super the same. China's not in a world system that can handle the same thing. And also, we're in much more of a truly world system than we were in 1910. But we're at a point that would indicate that just economically, we are no longer in the same position imperially, but there's no clear person to entirely take us back up. And the only way they got settled last time was a world war, or two of them, actually. So, I don't see that on the horizon either because of nuclear bombs. So what are we looking at? I have no idea. To bring it very meta, I think the Atlantic article's worrying about reasons completely different than what everyone else is worried about it. I think the emperor has no clothes is not about Trump anymore. It's about the Constitution.
No, that's what I just said, right?
Right.
So we're agreeing, even though you're kind of yelling at me.
I'm yelling.
Okay. So, I do think that it's not an unreasonable expectation, despite the history and despite the ornate quality of our government and the way things are patched together, to be able for people to expect that when they vote, their vote's counted, and that when there's a pandemic, that things are done so that it can be that mail-in ballots work. I mean, this may be difficult, but it's not insurmountable. But so I think both parties are on the hook for that not having been done adequately.
Right. I mean, but I will say that
the what I'm saying that is like, and gosh darn it, I'm going to write a letter to the newspaper that nobody reads anymore.
Right.
I mean, right. You know, what's my point, I guess.
But when we think about the comparable societies right now in the world, they're not democratic, or they're only kind of democratic, or they're right now ruled by oligarchs where there's some level of democracy, but there's so much of a, even if the vote is legitimate, which I don't know that there's a reason not to think it is, that there isn't really any other viable choice. So it's effectively not a democratic system. Like if you look at Russia and you look at China, which would be the only other country that you could compare to us for scale and a democracy like this is India. Mm-hmm. And then maybe after that, Brazil. And we both know how those have been looking lately. Yeah, so, like, the other thing...
But I'm just saying, like, in terms of physical infrastructure and technology...
Oh, yeah, we should be able to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's we should be able to do it, and we didn't... We have not been able to garner the manpower and the energy and the will since March to make sure we could hold a presidential election that didn't get gummed up and fucked up. Right. And that should have been, but there's our problem. And that's why it comes down to the democratic structures, because it's not so much the matter of not having the actual physical power or the resources, just not being able to get the government to work competently enough to get their own elections going. I mean, it makes me think about Iowa, right, in the primaries, and how screwy that was, and how that was a consequence really of the trying to change some of the rules. What they did was they changed the rules for how the caucus was run to make it more transparent, which made it impossible to run efficiently because it had never been running efficiently.
Right, because it's, you know, the
but now we can all see it, and so now they had to do things to try to get it to look like it was running well, and it slowed everything down to a crawl to try to implement these rules that had been passed in 4 years earlier. So,
yeah. So there's the things I want to like hit at though, and maybe this will move us into the private yeah. part, which is actually the, you know, for us today, actually the more substantive part of the conversation. Sorry, yeah. Freebies. The thing I want to think about is, what does this say about the bourgeois state? Not just as happening in America, but that it's really kind of happening and a lot of key places where you're seeing these norms and stuff really break down. Why would this period of capitalist development be unable? I mean, I was thinking about this the other day. Like we keep on talking about how shitty our elites are, and they are, right? But why would we have the most money in educational systems? We have more resources in that tied up than ever before. We have we have people who have levels of wealth and educational backing that has never existed on the planet, and yet we are producing the most deracinated. It's not. We're not even getting like petty beer. Like somebody was like, "Oh, this is like watching, you know, the Soviet Union had a debate over the general secretaryship in the 70s. You'd just see geriatric old men yelling at each other." And I was like, "Yeah, but they were competent. Like we can't even do that. Like what?" You know, Brezhnev was a joke, but it wouldn't have looked like that. That a Brezhnev like Khrushchev debate would not have looked like a Trump Biden one in any way, form, or fashion. So, what does it say about where we're at right now, and why is it also happening not just here? Because the one thing I've been noticing since COVID is America has really turned insular and has ignored that the rest of the world is still kind of on fire, like. Not as badly, not as obviously, but it is. And not all from COVID. In fact, most of it probably isn't from COVID, despite the COVID death toll.
Well, I know that when it comes to COVID-19 and our response to it, we lead the world in the infection rate. We don't lead the world as a nation in the deaths per million. As a nation with the population size we do, we're probably on top, but if you compare us to like the EU, where
we're still not catching up to
we're a little ahead, but
we're not catching up to to Britain at its height, though. Britain still has the like highest fatality rate per COVID infection on the planet.
I think. Per COVID infection, but not deaths per million.
Not deaths per million.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, so the COVID infection rate, I mean, Trump is right about one thing. The more you test, the higher it's going to be.
Right.
And so the thing to look at is the deaths per million, I think, is a pretty solid. So
we're at about 1% unless
you're like number 9 in the world.
Right. And it's death per million is it ends up being about 1% unless you're over 70 and it's really bad.
1%, I think. Yeah.
I think it's like point. I think it's like 0.8. It's approaching one, but it's not.
Yeah,
it's
like 0.7. But yeah.
But when you hit over 70, it jumps up dramatically. But it does that everywhere.
Yeah. Right. So, but the point here is that the EU is better off than we are in terms of deaths per million. Not good. And it's only they have 240,000 dead. We have 200,000 dead, roughly.
Yeah, the places that have fared well are basically islands.
Yeah.
I mean, well,
except for the UK.
Except for the UK. But like New Zealand, Vietnam's not an island, but it was able to effectively lock down.
We don't truly know who's fared well in some ways because we don't really know what the death count is in certain places.
But Vietnam's pretty transparent.
Yeah, but the people who fared well were the people who've been through it before.
Oh yeah, that's also true. I mean, there've been all kinds of COVID related,
in South Korea, they already had fever clinics set up.
Hoofing mouth disease checkpoints and stuff when I lived there. So like they're ready and I will also say because I have friends that are still in Korea. I was talking to one the other day. They're still guessing that this COVID stuff, even with a functional vaccine within the year, would be a problem for 3 to 5 years. Like, because even with most of the vaccines that are available, you're still a carrier. They're not sterilization vaccines, et cetera. So
if we can get deaths per year down to 80,000 a year or 90,000 a year, then we can ignore it.
Like we do before. One of the things I found amusing that I didn't realize until when everyone was comparing this to the flu, I was like, well, you know, the flu like is the only it's the only contagious thing in the top until COVID in the top 10% of things that kill people. That was a fact I did not know until I was like, oh, so it's like cancer, cars, suicide,
heart disease,
diabetes, the flu. Like, and I was like, whoa, I didn't even I don't know. Maybe I take the flu more seriously now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's no small thing. Trump said it's a big deal, the flu. People don't realize how many people die. It's terrible, awful.
It's one of these things where Trump does this double. I was trying to describe his intelligence to people the other day, and people thought I was defending him, and I wasn't. But I'm like, he's got a reptile intelligence where a lot of times he says things that, if he wasn't also counter-signaling to something else, would be just kind of true. But there's this double signaling going on, and it's hard to know. I mean, sometimes I don't even know if he means it. He's just good at it. Like, I think he means it, but I don't know. This is not a new trait amongst Republican politicians either, but he's like the master of it.
Right. I do think he's different than most other politicians. And I do think that, well, we'll talk about the debate and for the Patreon, for the Parrot Room. And we'll also talk about why you shouted at me through this entire thing.
I'm just shouting because my mic's over here and I want to make sure I'm heard. Actually, okay, I'm not actually right. trying to all yell right. at you. We're in agreement.
I've become like, I cancel people all the time on Facebook now. Not like I try to get them fired or anything, but just like I'm unfriending like crazy. I've become touchy as hell. I'm not sure.
I think everybody has done. I mean, one of the things that I've found that like, I was just talking to someone else. I was talking to my partner, and she and I were talking about how since the debates, everybody's had a hair trigger online, like, and been hyper uncharitable and just in a chaotic mood. And she's like, yeah, this is always bad in America around debate time, but like, I don't ever remember it being this intense before.
And I think everyone thinks that they're above it. Like,
right.
I'm a smart guy. I can watch these two candidates act like, you know, 6 year olds.
I was gritting my teeth. I was just like, man, why did I subject myself to this shit show? I don't know. And I did the exact same thing. I'm above this. I'm not going to do it. Oh, I got to talk about it on Thursday night. I'll listen. And then I was like, I hate both these. I was ranting in my car. And I just felt like very conventionally political. And then I was like, this has the world spirit of a shit show football game.
It's not good for anybody to experience.
Right.
So anyway, we'll talk about that too. Thanks for everyone for watching. Next time we do this, which will be in 2 weeks, we're going to do this much more consistently going forward. I'm revamping the YouTube channel. I put up a new banner. I'm going to be more consistent on putting videos out on a particular schedule. One of them is on Thursdays. There will be a live stream here. It will either be Pop the Left or Zero Squared. We'll do the second half in what I'm calling the Parrot Room, based on Mickey Kaus and Robert Wright's podcast, which goes to show you I'm getting old, because these are the people I'm a fan of. These two centrist old men. What is that about? Well, we can talk about it in the Parrot Room, and I'm going to end it here. But next time, also you'll be able to ask a few questions, and we'll make time for that. All right, so I'm ending it here.